All right. Saw a couple of faces from here in the animal behavior seminar earlier today. So thanks to those who came for that. Hope that was interesting. Clive always gives entertaining talks. But from dogs to mate choice today. So in this unit, it's two lecture unit. So that means that this upcoming weekend there is a reading assignment and a Canvas exercise due Sunday. Otherwise, we've got our group project. So again, the next deliverables are basically the end of the project, the presentation upload, which will be Wednesday of that week, just before finals week. Then you'll upload it. You aren't going to present them in class. You'll then be assigned a peer review. So each individual will watch one video from another group and then fill out a rubric and leave some comments. And that will be that for that. As you're rounding out your plans for your presentation here, try to be specific about your hypotheses. Try to keep a narrow focus, and that'll hopefully make it easier so that you're not trying to look for some grand theory. You're looking for, what is there an effect of this particular thing on this particular response? That's really all that you're kind of proposing, just within that context of kind of a con bio, conservation bio, animals interacting with humans perspective or context. So that's where the causal question will come into play and so on. So, but overall, this is really an exercise in getting you to form causal questions and hypotheses and then try to come up with structures of experiments that might tease those apart. So that's also hopefully going to be highlighted in that. And then little things like remember to italicize your Latin binomials because we're biologists. That's how we dot our I's and cross our T's. We italicize our binomials. So remember to do that. Otherwise, last week of classes, we're going to have a final exam review lecture on Tuesday. The presentation will be due on Wednesday. Stage one, the individual phase of the final exam. I'm going to make it available Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of that week. Latin binomials like Homo sapiens. So the Latin two-word names of your, so if you list your genus and species, so your the genus, the generic name, and the specific epithet of that, so Homo and sapiens, then just make sure you italicize them, because that's just the convention that they always have to be italicized. Like a Canis lupus, you'd have to, if you wrote it out, just make sure you italicize it. Yep. So Tuesday, the exam review, Wednesday presentations are due. Thursday, we've got the individual stage of the exam. I'm going to make it available Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then your peer reviews will be due then Saturday. And then stage two final exam, someone will staff this room during the official final exam period, which I think is Tuesday afternoon. It's on the Canvas calendar. It's the official one from the ASU final exam calendar. So if you want to take your collaborative stage two, you can come here just like the midterm, but you don't have to. And I'll make it available all week, finals week. It's auto-graded. That's just easy for me to do. So that's the plan there. So any questions about the schedule moving forward? So those of you who don't, based on your final exam schedule or trying to get out of here early or whatever, both of these are Canvas-based exams. There's Respondus is required for the Thursday one, but not for the finals exam week one. So there should be a lot of flexibility with respect to this class and your end of semester plans. Okay. All right. So we're starting talking formally about sex this week. So in this class, when we were talking about sex, there's three things we could be referring to. So we could be referring to meiosis, so cell division that results in the production of haploid gametes, as in sperm and egg. So this is, sex. The key reason why we call this sex is because in order to produce a gamete, it requires recombination. In all but a few really weird cases, meiosis requires recombination of a mixture of genes from parent and from the two parents, and that recombination creates a haploid gamete that is half the number of genes, but it is neither a clone of the father nor mother. So that's sex. It could also be the act of mating itself. The biomechanical process results in the contact between gametes, however that might be. That could be something that involves two animals coming together, or it could be the process of putting the gametes, say, into the water column and waiting for the gametes to interact that way. And then physiological and anatomical differences correlated with the production of different types of gametes. So we have primary sexual characteristics, so directly assorted with reproduction, usually identifiable at birth. So again, like the biomechanics of mating, the tools of mating, the development of offspring. So there might be development of offspring before birth and oviposition. Then there's also secondary sexual characteristics that are associated with sex, but unrelated to reproduction. So those might be related to sexual selection, both inter and intra-sexual selection. So there might be signaling going on there. It could be related to parental care, so caring for offspring after birth. So those are, these secondary ones. So in this class, we refer to sex. We're not referring to gender. So those are distinct elements here, and the consistent sex-linked behavioral differences. It will be tempting at first to say that they're all tied to the gamete size. So it'll be tempting at first to say that anything that produces a small gamete is going to tend to have certain sets of behavioral characteristics. But as we'll get to towards the end of this lecture, it's going to be better predicted by the level of investment. And the size of the gamete is not always a good predictor of the level of investment. So we won't necessarily always have, traditional male behaviors and traditional female behaviors. It's always going to depend, like anything else in animal behavior. All right, so that's the layout of what we mean by sex in this unit. So we talk about haploid and diploid. So haploid, sometimes monoploid, having one set of each chromosome. Diploid or diploid, having two sets of each chromosomes. So when we talk about mammals traditionally, all in sort of a rare set of cases, we talk about your somatic cells. Those are going to be diploid. So inside the cells of your body, each one of those cells, aside from red blood cells, are going to have a nucleus that will have a dual set of chromosomes. That's diploid. But then the gametes that are produced are then haploid. So males produce sperm. That's how we define males in this sex framework, where we're saying that the organism here that produces the smaller of the two gametes, when there's a difference in gamete size, we're going to call male. And otherwise, if they produce the larger of the two gametes, we're going to call female. So the gamete the females produce, we're calling eggs. The gamete the males produce, we're calling sperm or spermatozoa. So these are relatively small and motile. These are relatively large and non-motile. It's the key characteristic of these two. So that's how we're defining things. Now, when you look at this, and as an evolutionary biologist, this is a puzzling picture. Because this meiosis, where you start out with this number of genes, this number of chromosomes, and then you cut it down by half, then you lose half of your genetic material when it produces these haploid gametes. And that's weird. Because if you think about it, why would you have genes up here that code for the machinery that makes this happen? And that will result in an output, a haploid, gamete here that's only got a 50% chance of those genes being there. And so that seems like you're setting yourself up for, potentially moving yourself out of the population. So how could this possibly persist? That's sort of the conundrum there, is that why would you get rid of half of your genetic material in this random way? How could this possibly have enough of an advantage to make it so that sex would spread through a population? So that's a question that we have to get to as well. Okay, so as I mentioned, humans, almost all mammals are diploid, except for a few weird exceptions for certain cell types. So you can have polyploid cell types in mammals. And so higher ploidy can be found in other animals outside of the mammals, and a ton of it in plants. So you've got your cells of your developing animal organism tend to be there, that diploid. But there are animals that are entirely haploid. So there are animals that have cells in their body that only have one set of chromosomes. Can anybody think of one? Know of one, just off the trivia? It's one that's a, it's a group of animals that I talk about a lot. Yeah. Seahorses are interesting for reasons that we'll get to, but that's not what I'm looking for here. Yep. Bees, ants, wasps. So these social Hymenoptera, or Hymenoptera in general, these have a haplodiploid sex determinism system. So you're seeing here, this is a male bee, another male bee, a male wasp, a male ant, and another male ant. So you notice that in the ant cases, the ant males are going to typically have wings because they're dispersal morphs. They fly away to find mates. So even though most workers you see don't have wings, they have wings. They've got really tiny heads relative to the queens. So they're very distinctive. So you know, that's what you're seeing here. So kind of a funny looking organism here. And then the bees, there's a bunch of different morphological differences here. The wasps, maybe it's harder to tell a wasp male unless you're a wasp specialist here. But in all of these cases, they're flying sperm. So they're, you know, every cell of this male bee's body has got just a single set of chromosomes. So it's kind of interesting. So you don't need a diploid set in order to express all the phenotypes that you need to be a full animal. And so these males, they see, they you know, they produce sperm, they forage. You know, they have to, you know, they eat. So they do all of the things that, you know, the females do. Well, they don't do all of the things the females do. They do all the things you'd expect a male animal to do, but they do it with only one set of chromosomes. And that's how these set of animals, these particular set of insects, determine their sex, is if the queen fertilizes an egg, aside from a few abnormalities, it's going to become female. If she doesn't fertilize an egg and lets the egg develop, it'll become male. They're male by default, they're fertilized, and that's what makes them become female. So kind of a fun little trivia there. And this actually makes genetics with them pretty interesting because you can test for phenotypes here and you don't have to worry about the recombination, or you don't have to worry about what's expressed. Like in my body right now, different cells are expressing alleles from different chromosomes. And so, and it can be random, at least in, well, I should say in the case of females. So everyone who has an XX here in the room right now, like I have an XY. And so I only have one set of X's. And so all of my X genes are expressing from the one X that I have. But in, as you probably learned in genetics, then everyone in the room with an XX, in a random set of your cells, one set of X's is being expressed and the other one's silenced. And in the other set, the other ones are. So, you know, you get that random silencing that's going on throughout all the cells of the body. So it's kind of interesting there. But through the rest of the chromosomes, you get, you can get expression from both chromosomes simultaneously. It kind of makes things complicated. But here, you can actually get expression from a single haploid genome, which is kind of cool. Yeah. It's a, so the question was, does recombination happen? It turns out it does still happen, but the males, when a queen has a male, it's when a queen produces an egg, that egg is the product of recombination between her two. So it's true that the egg doesn't have two, you know, it's a haploid egg, but that wasn't a clone of the father. Now there are ants and potentially other animals that do clone the father and clone the mother. So for example, there is an ant that you see that is all around here called a crazy ant. It's very frenetic. It's the little one, Paratrachina longicornis. And it was one of the first ants found that has something called double cloning. These ants have no inbreeding depression. And so they're very, it's a terrible term, but they're called very trampy. So they move around from place to place and they can just set up shop anywhere and they just mate with each other and they have no inbreeding depression. And what they found is that that when a queen produces, fertilizes sperm and egg together, she produces workers. But when she produces a new male, she actually produces a haploid male. So I'll pick a random ant here. So here we go, a haploid male, where she discards her genetic material entirely and clones the father. And so her son is a clone of the father. And when she produces a new queen, a new daughter who will become a new queen, she clones herself. So her daughter sexuals are clones of herself. Her sons, who are automatically sexuals, are clones of the father. So they have no inbreeding depression because it's the same pair over and over and over again. And so that's the way they've got around it, and that's how they can move around. So there are weird things that happen, especially in this haplodiploid system. So I've got a graduate seminar that I run with a couple other faculty on Wednesdays, where we read new results that come out. And the paper we're reading tomorrow, it happens to be about an ant that you find in Portugal and in Spain, that it is a male that has lost its species. So it's basically a male that has because another ant of another species has developed the ability to clone this male. This male has latched onto that ant and has started mating exclusively with that ant, and it has lost effectively the rest of its species. And so it's like a parasitic male. Imagine if you had a male human that could mate with some other hominid and produce clones of itself. And at that point, 100% of its genes were carried through that other hominid. Well, then to those genes, you want to avoid human mating and only mate out of species because you actually get 100% transmission and not 50% transmission. And that's effectively what's going on with those ants. So it's a little weird kind of sci-fi thing. So there's a lot of weird things that can happen in this sex determination system, and really all sex determination systems. I just want to pick on this one. Biology is just weird. All right. So any questions about this system? So that's the basics we're setting up about haploid, diploid, and all the terminology. All right. So let's do a quick clicker then. And so this should be pretty easy after that long discussion. But so how many of each chromosome do male ants have, and do male ants, bees, and wasps have in their somatic cells? Is it one, two, three, or four? So hopefully that's quick. I'll let that go for another, because we had all of that discussion, I'll let that go for maybe another 10 seconds. Right now we've got about 86% of the class going with A and about 14% going with B. So I'm going to hit stop right now. And so yeah, I was looking for A. So happens to be that ants, bees, and wasps have this haploid sex determination system, haplodiploid sex determination system. So every cell of a male's body has only one set of chromosomes. A female's body's got two sets. Okay. So how do we explain some of these mysteries that we were talking about? This is one of the classic examples, the classic explanations. Seems to hold for many examples, but it's not perfect. But we're going to go down our kind of classic frameworks. This is called Bateman's principle. And so Bateman's principle, it might be easier rather than me reading this aloud, but I'll kind of go through these graphs here. So Bateman's principle, if you think about it, you've got a male over here, and that male has a mating. So it mates, it finds an egg, it has this mating. Now, you imagine, how does the number of offspring vary with additional matings? Imagine they're with additional females. Well, so let's say they get some number of offspring. So there's some litter size here. We'll call it one to be easy. And then we can say that, okay, well, then they mate with another female. If it's a different female, so we're talking about in polygyny here, one male, multiple females, then they get another batch of those offspring. And that just keeps happening. So the more they mate with, the more offspring they get. So if they want more fitness, they would need more matings. That was the thought here. Now, what's happening on the flip side of that? So on the female side of that, she's got an egg. And so she goes through her first mating and she's going to have a certain number of offspring. But if she invests a lot of time in the care of that offspring, in just not in fact, it could even be just in the gestation of that offspring, then additional matings are not on the table. So there, if she does have additional matings, at least for some period of time, those are going to be failed fertilizations. So the thought is that we can compare these two, and it suggests that there might be two different types of behaviors that would evolve. One that is going to favor multiple matings for males, and one that is going to favor being very choosy about matings for females. That's the thought behind Bateman's principle. Because if you've only got one shot to mate, and then you won't be able to mate for a while, you better make sure that one shot is a good one. Otherwise, over here, you want to maximize your opportunities to take shots. So that's the thought here. And so if you go from this, what does this predict? Well, this predicts then that the males are going to have such high benefits from extra matings that there's going to be high pressure on them from sexual selection to be very showy, to have a lot of displays, to be the benefactor, to benefit from the choice of females. And so the thought is you might see extreme sexual dimorphism in males, where the females aren't, they might look relatively similar, and there's not going to be a lot of variation among them, and they won't be necessarily very showy. But the males, you're going to get these sexually, these the pressure for these sexual signals that we've talked about in previous lectures here. And so from that, then you get high degrees of mate choosiness in the females. And so the females then use these signals to make choices on who to mate with. That's one potential prediction of this Bateman's principle. And that maybe that explains why males in a lot of species are the brighter ones. It's because they have less investment per mate, per mating. They have a higher benefit for lots of matings in order to get, and the females have the opposite. So when you join those things together, then the males try to be very showy and attract lots of matings, and the females are very choosy and are very selective on who they mate with. Maybe that is what explains that. Questions about that idea? That one consequence of Bateman's principle, one prediction of this hypothesis. Alternatively, you can get a little more gruesome predictions in that if a male needs multiple matings, it can try to be as showy as possible depending on female mate choice, or you get the evolution like you do in ducks or in many other animals of forced copulation, where the males are able to force themselves onto the female. And then so you see again that a lot in ducks and geese, but then that leads to kind of a war between the sexes because then females then evolve defenses against it. So you find that the males might have a tendency towards polygyny, but then you get a pressure for monogamy from the female side of things. And so females can evolve defenses against these things. So, and this happens not only in terms of behavior, but also in terms of morphology. So if you've never, heard this before, great thing to Google after class, but the corkscrew penis of a duck, for example, is, this is thought to be an arms race in that the female reproductive tract in ducks has become very convoluted, as is thought to be to make it very difficult for the duck penis to do its job. And so then the duck penis has now evolved different shapes in order to better fit into the maze that is the female reproductive tract of the duck females. And so, weird things that can happen in terms of morphology, but also in terms of behavior. So that's one potential consequence to this. You can also get mate guarding by males. And so this is where, even though males may have a benefit from multiple matings, if there's not an opportunity for multiple matings, then you can actually get the evolution of monogamy, where males, and it's a terrible term, but you can tell that males were probably the male humans are probably the ones that first came up with these terms. But it's this idea that after a male has mated with a female, it hangs around and prevents access to that female by other males. And that's so-called mate guarding. And that's, again, the thought that it's to sort of maximize the chances that if the female's only going to mate and produce an offspring from one mating, then how do you make it that it's your mating? So that's another potential prediction of this Bateman's principle. And then you can continue to take that even further. And so I've gone from polygyny to monogamy, and then potentially you can get conditions for polyandry, so where you have females that mate with multiple males, like you have here. So here, in this critter here, you've got very large testicles that are being seen there, and it turns out that in animals like this, they each male produces a relatively low amount of sperm, and so every time a female mates with a male, there's a good chance that that male might be on empty and she might not get very much out of it. And so, in order for her to maximize her chances of actually getting up this peak, then she might actually start mating with multiple males. And in that case, you start seeing the evolution of these showy signals, like here, these, large and very conspicuous testicles, which are the females are shown to be used in sort of their used for their own selection activities in order to try to maximize the amount of sperm that they receive so that they can manage to even get to this first fertilization. So Bateman's principle, although it does tend to favor explanations where the male is showy, and the female is choosing, and the male is trying to have lots of mates, and the female is trying to have one mate, there are conditions in which even Bateman's principle can seem to sort of flip, and where the female is now trying to have multiple matings. But still, the idea here is the male is still the showier one. It just happens to be that the female is choosing who to mate with. And the female happens to need to mate with lots of males in order to even get to the first fertilization. So a lot of things can still come out of Bateman's principle, but it's not exactly there's plenty of taxa that it seems to fit, but then there are taxa that we're going to talk about where it maybe doesn't quite fit by itself. All right, any questions about Bateman's principle? These two graphs, like understanding the differential fitness between males and females in terms of number and matings, like that's the key point here. Yeah. Well, so and maybe the scale is off, but it's still the case that if a male could produce enough sperm, then the male, in this case, even if a male is not producing a lot of sperm, it's still going to be the case that if they can manage to get enough sperm to do a fertilization, they are now free to go and mate again. I guess your point is, well, if they deplete all their sperm, I have to wait for it. But this is like not so that much necessarily a depletion effect, but it's just they don't make sperm. They just don't make a lot of sperm. They don't produce a lot of sperm in every mating. So it's still, if they can manage to get multiple matings, then the thought is that they could still get more fitness. Now, what you're talking about, we're going to see, like there's already a mention of seahorses, and we're going to talk about pipefish. And in that case, it's going to be much more like, I think, what you're getting at, where you're saying, well, in the male case, after the first mating, the male really is off the market. And at that point, it really matters what their first mating is. And that might be, this might be bending a little bit due to depletion effects, but it's not like after the male's mated and has now a fertilized offspring that they now are stuck with the fertilized offspring. Whereas the female is still, she's kind of stuck with it. at least if she's like there are, if she's laying eggs and they're fertilized outside of her body, then things change. So there's all sorts of weird things that can change based on where the eggs are and where they're fertilized. But if they're fertilized in her, then she's kind of, she has to, then you get this curve. Because once she's stuck with it, she can't have more matings. Whereas the male might have to wait a little bit of time to get the sperm load back up, but then he can go out. And the thought is that they can probably make multiple matings while they're waiting for their first offspring to develop. So the offspring's developing with the female, she's off the market while the offspring's developing, the male is out franchising. Does that make sense? Okay. Yep. Well, the thought was here is that if you happen to have a situation where males, some males have very, very little sperm in their ejaculate, and then it causes the female to have a risk where they don't know. That's why the signaling exists. Every mating, they don't know if that mating had little sperm transfer, a lot of sperm transfer. So if there's a high probability that the only males they're mating with have very little sperm transfer, then they might then start mating with multiple males. But and so the thought is that there's going to be signaling systems that evolve that become honest signals of the ejaculate, the amount of sperm in the ejaculate for these males, and females will then home in on that so they don't have to mate with multiple males. But if all that they have access to are males that are signaling low sperm count, then they might mate with multiple males because that's the highest probability of getting enough sperm to actually reach the first fertilization. So it all has to do with in these species that for physiological and ecological reasons happen to have very low sperm count, then under these low sperm count conditions, then and for a female to get any fitness, she needs to actually climb this hill. Whereas in most other species, after one mating, she's at the top of the hill, and then she can flip to the flat strategy. That's the hypothesis behind these. Okay, great. Good questions. So while we're talking about sperm, if you do have polyandry, it opens up some interesting additional behaviors now at the level of the sperm. So there's this term we call sperm competition, which is competition between sperm after they're released by the male. So this can happen among a male's sperm, among one male's sperm, they can compete with each other. But if you have polyandry, now you've got a female mated with more than one male. She's going to have sperm from multiple males inside her, and those sperm actually can compete. And in animals with sperm competition, if you look at the sperm under a microscope, you actually find that they have all these interesting adaptations to fight the sperm around them. And so, there might be particularly fast swimmers, or they've got certain shapes that kind of allow them to crowd out other sperm. So you actually get the evolution of phenotypes for competition that occur at the level of sperm. Now, in other cases, like if you have, there are plenty of insects that multiply mate, but in ants that, and there are ants that multiply mate, but there are ants that singly mate, and then the female will store sperm for as long as 30 years in her body. And she then, whenever she needs to produce new workers, she samples from her stored sperm, like a sperm bank, she produces new workers. Those sperm don't have to compete with each other, and they've actually lost their tail. So they're basically just these little pinballs. That they're just stored there because they don't have to rush towards an egg. They're just a bank that she then grabs and then fertilizes, produces the egg. And so they've lost the ability to kind of do the sort of the zoa part of spermatozoa. Like they just become genetic material. Whereas in these types of animals where you can have multiple unrelated sperm in the same location, they evolve these abilities for one sperm to try to get ahead of the other sperm. And then there are some interesting cases where you actually get, it's kind of like in the Tour de France, like in the middle of the race, sometimes you get the cooperative behaviors where they all get in a line, and so they can kind of draft with each other, and it's kind of like ducks, but not in the mating sense. They can like rotate, who's a head, and then eventually they'll break off or whatever. Well, you can actually get sperm that have these adaptations where they link tail and head together, and you get this giant sperm train, and that sperm train tends to move faster than the sperm around it. So they get this little drafting setup going up, and then when they finally get to the egg, they break apart and then they compete again. So lots of cool things are going to happen at the level of individual sperm when you've got sperm from multiple males. Or you imagine if you've got related sperm near you and unrelated sperm, maybe you want to do that drafting thing with your related sperm, but somehow reject your unrelated sperm. Well, then how are sperm telling the difference? There's all sorts of cool questions you can ask about sperm competition, which some people do. I don't. Some people do. So that's what we're just sort of saying here. So question about that sperm competition. So it's competition between sperm. It's not competition for sperm. All right. So like I said, that's Bateman's principle, these two graphs. And so the question is this really everything? So how general is Bateman's principle? And is it really all described by the fact that these are small motile gametes and these are large non-motile gametes? Is that it? And that brings up examples like this, the spermatophore. So in a lot of arthropods and some of these salamanders, males not only have sperm that they transfer, but they transfer this giant structure called a spermatophore that has sperm as well as nutrients that are valuable to the female, which have been called, again, probably a terrible term, nuptial gifts. And so not only are they transferring genetic material, but they're transferring material which may not be used by the offspring itself, may actually be used by the female. So it's an additional package that can be given to the female that can maybe entice her to choose that male. And in these cases, it takes a lot of investment for for this Mormon cricket to generate that thing. And so in these cases, this investment can lead to a shift in the choosiness here. So the thought here is that with these spermatophores, that I thought I had one more slide on this spermatophore thing, that that here the male is sort of having to choose which female to give the spermatophore to because it's such a huge investment. So it's less about the size of the gamete here and more about the support structure that is passed between sexual individuals that seems to be driving the behavior. Now, in most males in the animal kingdom, you don't have these spermatophores. You've got just the individual sperm. And maybe Bateman's principle makes a lot of sense there. But at the point where the males start investing in these nuptial gifts, then things might switch. And that brings us to the seahorse. And generally, this group of fish. So, this is seahorse, pipefish, and sea dragons. So, a cool thing about this group of fish, the synaphid fish, is that the males are the ones that carry the offspring. So, rather than males depositing sperm in a female, females can deposit eggs in a pouch or a rift. They can deposit eggs on or in the male. And then the male can fertilize those eggs and bring those eggs all the way to maturity. And so it's a huge investment for the males and less investment for the females. Now, we have to be careful here. So a lot of times people have heard about the seahorse before, and people will say, oh, well, so sex roles are reversed in the seahorse. It turns out for the seahorse, it's actually not that way. Despite the male putting in this huge amount of investment, the energetic investment in producing the eggs is much higher for the female. So it is still such a high investment in the female that you don't get quite the sex role reversal in seahorses that I think a lot of times you hear about. But in the pipefish, which is related, if you do the math, if you actually study the energetics of how energetically costly is producing an egg versus raising an egg here. At this point, then the males in the pipefish spend more effort in offspring rearing or offspring production than the females. And in the pipefish, you most definitely get male showy behaviors that look like, in other species, female showy behaviors. And I've got an example of this here. So this is a so-called breeding sail of this species of pipefish. If you looked at this, you might think this here would be a male in another species, like a jumping spider. It looks just like a peacock jumping spider's tail there. But in reality, this is actually the female who is the showy one, has this beautiful breeding sail. And that kind of one that just looked like a little pipe, that was the male. That was the one that's actually going to take the egg, fertilize the egg, and then keep the egg there until the egg is ready to become a new pipefish. So in this case, you do get that kind of reversal of who's showy and who's not. And it seems to be predicted by the energetic investment. It's more costly for the male. So the female ends up being the one that develops the costly signals, and the male develops the costly kind of reproductive management system. All right, any questions about that? The pipefish example, where we kind of flip the roles of things. So here it's definitely not about the size of the gamete. The same principles are at play, but you have to kind of think more, think beyond the gamete. Okay. All right, pipefish. Okay, so let's do another one of these. Okay, so which sex carries the fertilized eggs in these synathid fish? So those again are like seahorses and pipefish. Is it the females? Is it the males? Do they both do it, or do none of them do it and they just deposit them into the water? So I'll give you a second for that. And you guys know that we drop like five for, so for those of you who've been here like all semester, I think we're in the point where it's not going to matter. So just putting that out there. All right, so that's about everybody. So, and almost everybody said males. That's what I was looking for. So I'm going to hit go ahead and hit stop. All right, but still we didn't have an answer. So we've talked about when there is sex, then we've started to understand how there could be differences in the behaviors among males and females. So under many circumstances, males might be showy. Females might be choosy. Under other circumstances, the opposite will hold. So we've talked about the ecological pressures when you have sexual organisms, but do you need sexual organisms? Do you need sex to be an animal? Why sex? And there are plenty of animals that don't have sex. These aphids here can produce sexually and asexually. So then if they can produce asexually, why are they bothering? Why are they paying the cost of sex? And then likewise, so we can look at this sea anemone. So sea anemones, like aphids, can do both. They can produce sexually and asexually. So they can produce, like, here's a big anemone, and here's an asexual bud that's going to pop off of this sea anemone, and it's going to be another sea anemone nearby, right nearby. But this sea anemone can also disperse gametes into the water that go far away from it and then produce new sea anemones quite far away. So that brings up a hypothesis about how might environmental conditions favor clonal reproduction versus sexual reproduction. What do you think here? So why might you expect asexual reproduction to be favored for offspring that are nearby, and sexual reproduction to be favored for offspring that are far away? What's a potential rationale for that? Why might clonal reproduction be better nearby and sexual reproduction be better far away? Is that hand? What do you mean by bad environmental conditions? So you're saying like it might be that so you're saying that you know the environmental conditions here are good, but far away might be bad? Or you're saying it might be bad here, Oh, and then you're developing. So yeah, that's a great hypothesis for why disperse, because it might be the case that, and why disperse sexually? That's definitely the case, is that you could say, well, if you're not doing well here and you have the ability to choose, then maybe this, let's roll the dice a little bit differently, reshuffle our genes, and then send ourselves off into a new conditions where maybe we'll be better, have better luck there. But it still doesn't quite explain then why asexual here, but it's getting there. It's really close to what I'm, possibility. Yep. Yeah, so it's kind of blending these two ideas here. Is there this idea that parents doing well, parents producing a lot of offspring, like why break something that isn't, that's already fixed? So that if the conditions here are good for the parent, then they're probably going to be good for the offspring. So nearby, you keep your genes exactly as they are. You have these little buds, and then far away, you have no idea what the conditions are going to be. And so regardless of whether you're doing well or not doing well here, far away, the conditions are probably different than here. And so that uncertainty might produce pressure for sex. And if you're in an environment where there's a lot of spatial differences, spatial heterogeneity, if you disperse, then most likely you're going to probably need to be different than you were from where you dispersed from. And sex allows you to roll the dice so that you have a better chance of producing offspring that are adapted for, those different conditions. That is a thought here. And so this is the kind of habitat stability hypothesis for the evolution of sex. If you have a stable habitat, you're probably going to get asexual reproduction. If you have an unstable habitat, there's no optimum, and you're always going to be chasing new things, and that's going to lead to sexual reproduction, which allows you to try to almost bet hedge, is that you're sort of saying, I'm taking a risk because things could be a lot worse if I shake up my genes, but I at least have a chance of hitting a combination that's a lot better. So uncertainty might drive sexual reproduction, is the thought here. And this idea, by the way, of clones nearby and sexuals far away, you see that in ants. There are ants that are like that. They have dispersal morphs that are effectively clonal nearby and sexual far away. As you see that pattern in a lot of different organisms, not just animal organisms. I think there's plant examples of that as well. And this all feeds into this idea of the so-called Red Queen hypothesis. So you should. If you take any evolution course or behavioral ecology course, you should know the Red Queen hypothesis. This comes from Lewis Carroll. Now here you see it takes all the running you do just to keep in the same place. So the thought here is that once you put multiple organisms that have the ability to change, it's going to have an even bigger driver on keeping things changing. And what do we mean by that? So we have an evolutionary arms race between, let's say, hosts and parasites, or hosts and diseases. So have a particular genetic makeup, and then a disease species nearby changes so that now you are a good target for them. So then that disease species becomes very prevalent. So then in another generation, the host overcomes that by changing their genes to being not a good match for the parasite. And of course, what's going to happen in the next generation? The parasite's going to keep up. So the Red Queen hypothesis, which is one of the prevailing hypotheses for the evolution and maintenance of sex, is that maybe you need sex because there are so many things that have the ability to change things up from generation to generation, that they're all chasing each other into this escalation behavior where everybody is always changing just to stay in the same place. So we have sex theoretically because we have disease that can have sex or can at least change their genetic makeup. And they can keep doing that. So then we have to keep doing that. And it goes back and forth. And so you end up changing, running just to stay in the same place. Questions about that general idea about the Red Queen here? Okay. We've already seen this basic idea from a previous lecture last week, where we talked about, prey and host. You can get these oscillations in population dynamics, like in the case of those fish, that was kind of an aquatic arms race where you have all of the left-eating parasites, and then you've got the fish that learn to then, whenever they feel anything nearby, they snap to the right, and that puts the left-eating fish at a disadvantage. So then the right-eating fish, so then the population of the parasites changes to feed on the other side, and then it takes a while for the host to snap back, and they go back and forth, and that puts themselves in this arms race. And that's what we showed here, where you get these oscillations. And so we see that in other traits. And so the thought is that, well, maybe that's also driving the evolution of sex, a similar idea going on there. All right. So any questions about that? The arms race that is the Red Queen hypothesis and the evolution of sex. Okay. All right. So, but you can have sex without having two different sized gametes. Why would you have a sperm that is way smaller and way more motile than an egg, which is way larger and way less motile? These are completely different phenotypes. Why would you have both of those in the same population? And so this is this anisogamous species. And remember, we're talking about this in behavior because there are, like by Bateman's principle, downstream behavioral consequences of this way the egg and sperm are set up. The fact that we have an egg and sperm sets up for all of these potential behavioral differences that we're very interested in as behaviorists. And so that is natural to ask the question, well, why the heck did it start this way? Why do we have those? And so, there can also be hermaphrodites, animals that have both male and female parts. And there are hermaphrodites that are one sex for one part of their life and another sex for another part of their life. So there's protoandrous. So you can think of like first male, protoandrous, like androgen male, and then protogynous. And so protoandrous hermaphrodites are males early. They're first males and then become females. Protogynous, the other way around, females early, males later. So you can have those. And so, but that still is, you're still producing egg and sperm. It's just you're producing them at different times of the life there. But there's also, isogamy that in theory you could have. And in other unicellular organisms, you see isogamy. So in unicellular organisms, you can see gametes that are just, there's no male and female, there's just gametes. There's just these haploid beads that are thrown out in the environment that meet with each other and they join up and they do everything that these do, but they just aren't in these very different packages. So the question is, and that, that doesn't tend to happen in animals, but it happens in other unicellular organisms that, and maybe it's the ancestral state of the gametes that we have in animals is a thought here. So question is then why, how do we, why do we stuck with these in animals? And this comes down to this idea of disruptive selection, which we talked about back before the midterm. So these are stabilizing selection, directional selection. This is how you can get a convergence on one phenotype. This is how you can get a phenotype kind of being driven to an extreme. And then this is this disruptive selection, which explains how you might get two coexisting phenotypes that are very different from each other. So the thought here is that you could have intermediate gametes here. So just that single, pinball gamete that looks just like any other gamete right in the middle here. But there's design trade-offs you can kind of think about. You'd say, well, what if I made it a little smaller? Well, if I made it a little smaller, then it could find other gametes faster because it's just, it could be, if there's just energy in the system, it will spread it around more easily. Maybe I can actually make it motile. Like maybe I can actually make it able to move by itself. Then it can find other gametes faster. But as I do that, then as it becomes smaller and so on, it's going to have less resources on board so that when you finally join with another gamete, there's going to be less resources available to start developing into, zygote, embryo, and so on. So you end up of not packaging enough resources in order to actually be useful after sex. But what if something was happening on the other side? So if I flip to the other side here, I could package more and more of those resources in. I'm going to get a gamete that doesn't move around very much. But when it manages to find a mate, then this particular gamete is going to have plenty of resources to guarantee to kick off development. And so the idea here behind disruptive selection is that because there's this trade-off where there's a benefit that goes in this direction here, but it trades off the other thing, you can create a pair of these. And so you can get the evolution of two groups where if this group happens to find this group, then it's kind of the perfect pairing. And it actually makes them do the gamete thing a lot better than if they were just this kind of intermediate thing. So imagine gametes here, they're like good at nothing. Like they have just enough resources to kick off development, but it's really hard for them to find each other. If you manage to get a few slightly faster and lighter ones and a few slightly heavier and more resourceful ones, those are more likely to succeed because the faster ones will be able to find the slower ones. And that can drive the selection for a group, a pool of roughly half of small gametes and large gametes, because this is actually two phenotypes that benefit each other. So there is a frequency-dependent selection here, and that if you have a lot of these available, then it's actually also beneficial to have these available. If there's only these available, then it's not beneficial to have these available and everybody goes back here. But if you start here, there's actually a process where of disruptive selection where you gradually over time get the two extremes coexisting and actually supporting each other, stabilizing each other in the population. And that's the thought as to how maybe in the unicellular case, before you got animals, you had a bunch of these, single gametes right here. And then once you started getting multicellular animals in the play, then you started to get this separation of gametes into these two groups. That's kind of the thought here is that you have moderate, short, and long-term rewards, kind of just a meh gamete here. Here you've got a gamete that is really amazing in short-term rewards. Here's one that's really amazing in long-term rewards. And if they could manage to find each other, they can do much better than the intermediate ones. That's disruptive selection. All right, so questions about that? That's why we think we have egg and sperm, which leads to male and female, which leads to all of the behavioral difference that we see between male and female across a bunch of different animals. Okay. All right, so then to close this up, we got male, we got female gametes here. What about mate selection? So this, there's these sperm are having to choose between the eggs. These eggs are having to choose between the sperm. So how does mate selection affect the outcome of sex? So what's going on with these selection processes? And so, this we've already talked about here that selection favors genetic combinations that accommodate habitat change. So, this evolves so that these combinations are constantly shifting during meiosis. So the thought here is that, well, maybe we would then want selection to support this idea so that you'd say, okay, a female might be looking for a signal in a male that signals that they have genes that are particularly good for this habitat. And that maybe sex allows for this selection to happen. And as you move from habitat to habitat to habitat, you might find that in certain habitats, certain types of males are able to produce these colors and other types of males aren't. But in another habitat, it flips who can produce these colors. But in all of the habitats, the colors provide you an honest signal that that male has genes that are well suited for that habitat. And so maybe that's what's going on with selection, is you're trying to find a mate that is better adapted for the habitat. But that isn't the only thing that could be going on. So that's what we're saying here. Now, oh yeah, so that, and this is, I almost forgot about this. I told you earlier in the class that when things are under selection, selection purges them of their genetic variation and thereby purges them of their heritability. Remember that heritability is the fraction of the phenotypic difference that can be explained by the genotypic difference in a population. For reasons that are mysterious still in many different species, that sexually traits that are related to sexual selection here tend to have high heritability for very long periods of time. Longer than you'd expect any other trait that is highly heritable and under selection. And so no one completely understands all of the causes of this, but one possibility is that if you're choosing a sexually selected, not you choosing, but if natural selection is converging upon a trait that will be a signal for sex, it might converge upon a signal that for whatever reason is very difficult to have great reductions in heritability. So it's the thought here that normally, if you breed, you're going to breed out the heritability out of your system. You use the heritability, and then after so many generations, everybody's got the same genes, and so any variations left over are due to the environment. But the rate at which that happens is going to differ from trait to trait to trait based on the genetic architecture underneath those traits. And so maybe there is a complex genetic architecture underlying sexually selected signaling traits that actually maybe are shaking things up and keeping the genetic variation high from generation to generation. And those just happen to be the things that are really great to be used for sexually selected signaling. It's not that the signaling is causing that, it's more like the signaling is co-opting that feature. And if you don't have that feature, then it's fine if this is what in this generation this meant that this peacock spider was particularly good for this habitat. But in the next generation, this may have no relationship to the genes inside the spider. This particular spider might have just gotten lucky and produced those colors. So that's why we really need those colors to relate to the genes inside the spider for them to be used for sexual signaling. All right. That's stuff we sort of already talked about. Any questions about that? The other thought behind sexual selection is that maybe it has to do with genetic compatibility. So this is another graph. This is Bateson's optimal outbreeding hypothesis. So the idea here is that, of course, inbreeding is bad. And so that's not good for the genetic architecture. But outbreeding also, if an individual that is way unrelated to you, mating with them can produce, can actually have a real detriment to fitness, can be a real problem for fitness. Because it's like, if they have a completely different, it's like blood types not mixing. If they have a completely different physiological configuration, then there may not be an easy blend between your genes and their genes. And so your offspring may have a bunch of problems because of that incompatibility. So the thought here is that maybe there is an optimal relatedness for breeding. So, and this is phrased in terms of relatedness, in terms of it's unfortunate, it's sort of, sib, cousin, second cousin. Not necessarily saying you should mate with your second cousin, but the idea is that there is a certain deviation from your genes that may be optimal in terms of a sexual mate. And if you go beyond that, you're going to have offspring, they're going to pay a price because they don't blend very well. If you go less than that, you're going to pay a price because you end up getting this inbreeding depression, all of these kind of the inbreeding forces there. So maybe there is this optimal point. And the thought is that if this is really hard to, I mean, like I can draw this on paper, but when you're actually choosing a mate, this is certainly I'm talking about within species, I think that's fine to sort of extrapolate to say that, yeah, if you have two different species, you might be able to manage to make an offspring, but that offspring themselves might not be viable. It might be a mule or something like that. Now you could also, there's these weird cases of hybrid vigor where, you actually maybe get some weird benefit of having a hybrid. But in most cases, the hybrid models, yeah, it would be kind of way out here on the relatedness scale. So you may have managed to make an offspring and it may have some strength, during its life history, but it's not producing any more offspring. So it itself, so a lot of these incompatibilities happen in the cell level. Like you can have cytoplasmic incompatibilities. So it might be that, like you inherit, like the offspring inherit the cytoplasm and the mitochondria from the mother and some fraction of nuclear DNA from the father, certainly all of the Y chromosome in the case of male offspring. You can get cytoplasmic incompatibilities between the male's nuclear DNA and the cell. And that incompatibility often wrecks reproduction for that offspring. So the offspring might be totally fine. They might even have some benefits. They might be super strong. There might be some other things going on with them, but they're going to have, but they're, but you know, it can really affect their reproduction. And ultimately, that's what we're sort of focusing on is kind of the fitness of the offspring, not necessarily other traits of the offspring. All right, but so how do you figure out though, is this mate, second cousin worthy? And whatever that means. And so there are these histocompatibility complexes. And so it turns out that, and this goes into if you take an immunology course, you're going to learn all about these things. But like every cell of your body has a fingerprint, a cell print. And it's randomized in the offspring versus the parents. And there's disease reasons. Again, this is why you learn about in immunology. This is how your immune system knows not to attack itself because it's like a password. And if your cells give your immune system this password, your immune system doesn't attack your own cells. But when they query other things, like if you get a liver transplant, they'll attack the liver because it tells the wrong password because it has the different histocompatibility complex than you do. And so the thought is that maybe you can actually sense the same thing that inside your body is allowing your immune system to tell the difference between self and non-self. Maybe you can sense that in another individual. And you can find these experiments in humans, for example, where they would like have a bunch of men run around in white t-shirts and get sweaty. And then they have them take off all their t-shirts and then they have a bunch of women smell the t-shirts. I know it's disgusting, but they do that. And then the women rank the t-shirts based on how they feel. It's like, yeah, that smells like an attractive guy. Who knows? But they rank them. And then they then show them pictures of those males. And they'll tell them what t-shirt went to which male, have them rank them. And then what they'll find is that they actually, the t-shirts are good predictors of who the choice is when they actually have the pictures. So the thought is that there may actually be chemical signals that are communicating chemical compatibility that might relate to sensing how far away this person is. So, this in some ways, it starts out as like a creepy, maybe it's still creepy for you, but it starts out as a creepy discussion. But I'm hoping it gets more interesting, almost more plausible. Like back here, I mean, this is the standard story we tell, but in some ways, this is almost an outlier. Like, you like at least as a human, we don't have quite as much showiness. When you're thinking about your own, struggles finding a mate or whatever, and your own preferences and things like this, I don't think it's like it's not like, oh yeah, I heard you went on a date last night. Who was it? Well, he had this really blue butt. It's like that's usually not the case. It's usually like, I don't know, there's something about him that, that really resonated with me. And that's sort of suggesting, something more along these lines. Like, I felt this person was compatible with me. And it may not be chemical compatibility, that might not be the proximate mechanism. There could be lots of other mechanisms for that. But however that compatibility is communicated, the theory behind me right now, this hypothesis is that there's some signal of how compatible they are with you, and that might hopefully give you an idea of their genetic compatibility if you were to mate with them. Yep. Well, so this is meant to be, this is not real data. These are not real data. This was this Bateson's optimal breeding hypothesis. It was like, well, we know that mating with sibs, we know mating with sibs leads to all sorts of bad things. Look at the British royal family and all that, you know. And you know, cousins, we also know that there's, you know, inbreeding issues. But, you know, after cousins, we see that fall off a little bit. And so that's kind of the idea there. And then it goes down because of like the hybridization sort of things. Once you get out here, they're genetically not compatible. Yeah. All right. Well, anyways, I think I've communicated that. So basically, it came down to it here. You know, mate selection adaptations help to infer whether a mate has good genes. Different animals in different situations are going to have different definitions of good genes. And signals of these good genes tend to remain highly heritable for mysterious reasons, but it makes sense that it's probably good for them to remain highly heritable, or else like they'd constantly be changing to kind of find a new signal. Talked about a lot. Happy to take questions afterwards. Let's close with a quick question here, and then we'll see you later this week. Short answer question. I guess the question here is, oh, you're a minute over, so just put the number two. And anybody who puts a two, that's fine. Everybody, so it's a different number. I'll probably just mark you zero for the day. So two. Have a good one.